morning and welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Since 2010, Ascot Resources has been trying to get a permit to conduct exploratory drilling for gold and copper deposits on Mount St. Helens, with plans to ultimately develop a mine. The proposed drilling project is located just outside the boundary of the Mount St. Helens National Volcanic Monument in the Green River Valley and would destroy popular recreation areas including Goat Mountain and the Green River Horse Camp. Meanwhile, for the last decade, the Cascade Forest Conservancy has worked to prevent mining exploration and development near Mount St. Helens. This morning we talk with Matt Little and Michael Ortzik with the Cascade Forest Conservancy about their efforts to permanently protect Mount St. Helens and environs from mineral exploration and development. Matt and Michael, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you.
Thanks. Very excited to be here.
Well, first, I want to talk about your name change before we get into anything else, because people probably haven't really heard of Cascade Forest Conservancy, but a lot of people might have heard of the Gifford Pinchot Task Force. So how did you become go from one to the other?
Yeah. Well, we're the same group as that we were at the beginning as Gifford Pinchot Task Force. We've been around for 30 years now. Since 1985, we started as an all-volunteer group of citizens that cared about the forest, especially the forest south of Mount Rainier to the gorge. And the name was a good fit for us then. We were a task force of citizen volunteers, and we were focused primarily on the Gifford Pinchot National Forest, which was going through its first national forest plan. And so these citizens, these forest activists, wanted to get together to stop old growth logging and protect streams. And they did a really good job. They helped change the planning for the National Forest. So here we are 30 years later, and we're a group with 10 staff, a great board. We have offices here in Vancouver and Portland. And we just wanted to have a name that connected better with the public on exactly what we do. And we protect Washington's South Cascades forest ecosystem. And we did a lot of polling, and the name really resonates with folks and describes what we do. We have the same mission that we did when we started, to protect Washington's South Cascades for the future and our kids.
It's a pretty new name too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fresh. We're celebrating it this year with a big event. But we just finished changing the name over this summer.
Well, as I recall, up until Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980, the Gifford Pinchot National Forest, I think, was the most heavily clear-cut national forest in the United States.
Oh, yeah. It's had its share of abuse. And the trees grow big and dense, and there was a lot of clear-cutting that was happening up until our group came together to try to stop that. And it took about 10 years before our group successfully ended old growth logging in the forest. There's still a lot of beautiful old growth forests left, including some that's at threat through this mine.
Actually, my recollection too is that some of the most heavily clear-cut areas of that national forest were inundated by mud flows when Mount St. Helens erupted. I think I saw some maps, and there was an interesting correlation. And my sense was at the time the mountain rose up and was angry at Georgia Pacific and the other logging companies.
Yeah, maybe. It's pretty neat. Some of those big giants actually survived the blast zone. And that's why the area where the mine is proposed is so unique. It's got a whole diversity of landscapes that researchers are studying to this day about how ecosystems recover.
Well, let's talk about this mine. I didn't hear about this until a few months ago. A canvasser from it was then the Gifford Pinchot Task Force came to my door and was trying to raise money for the organization and started talking about this mine that was being proposed on Mount St. Helens. And I kind of almost fell off my porch hearing that news. And then a few months later, person came back and said, as I mentioned, wanting to do a show about this. And he said, I understand you want to do a show on KVU about this. I said, yes. So here we are doing it now. But I had never heard of that mine, and I don't know how many other people have heard about it. So, and you told me before we went on the air that actually this is a proposal that goes back to, what, 2005 even, mm-hmm. and that you got wind of it in 2008. So why has it been going on for so long and so few people know about it?
Yeah, it started under a different company, General Molly. Even before that, it was Idaho General Mines, I think. And we did a big push against the mine proposal in 2008 and won, and we've won three different times. But I'll just describe the area first, just to see listeners can imagine where we're talking about. So we have the Mount St. Helens itself. Just north in the blast zone are these beautiful river valleys. One of them, the main one, is the Green River. It's this gorgeous river valley that's really untouched with very few roads. And the mine site that's proposed, and this is a gold and copper mine, that I'd love to talk about how nasty those can be.
Well, we should talk about that after we do this.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. This mine, this valley flows from east to west into the Columbia River, and it flows through this old growth forest and through the National Monument of Mount St. Helens. It flows downstream into the Toutle River, connects to the Cowlitz. It goes past the communities of Castle, Longview, Castle Rock, communities that depend on this river for water, drinking water, and into the Columbia. And on its way, it provides habitat for species like steelhead, which actually Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife designated the river as a gene bank, for a DNA gene bank for steelhead, because it's such a special run. There's incredible elk herds there. It's a great area to watch wildlife, to hunt. They're undisturbed. There's a backcountry horse camp there that's really cool. It's just a beautiful. We just did some footage for a video we're gonna put together on Friday. It took us 3 hours to get back there. It's just this remote, gorgeous river valley that would be totally destroyed by this mine.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what happens when you mine, because some people think you just kind of dig a hole in the ground, or you, the old days, you know, you're panning for gold on the Green River. But what really are the processes that transpire when mining happens?
Yeah, and ironically, we are dealing with kind of the new version of panning for gold these days. There's suction dredging going on in the streams in Gifford Pinchot National Forest too. But for this mine,
this is already going on.
There is another type of mining called suction dredge mining, which is kind of like a vacuum on a raft that just sucks up the bottom of the river and pans for gold. This is kind of hobbyists that do that. We're trying to get some state regulations that limit that or even ban it in fish-bearing streams. But for this big mine proposal, a gold and copper mine, to get all the gold and copper out, you have to dig out immense amounts of hard rock. And you have to crush it and add some chemicals that combine with the metals to pull it out. Use immense amounts of water from the river. And the scariest thing about a gold and copper mine is that all that sludge with the chemicals that you put in there to get the metal out, you have to put it somewhere. You can't just dump it back in the stream. So they create these incredibly huge tailings ponds, which are just full of toxic sludge. And they don't put it in a concrete, they're not, you know, held back by a concrete dam or anything. It's an earthen dam that holds these things back. And we're on the side of a volcano. And normally, even if you didn't have a volcano, these things fail all the time and leak, and it goes into the river systems. It ruins the drinking water, drains the habitat, the fish. It's just terrible. But can you imagine putting a mine like this on the side of a volcano in a beautiful place such as this? It just makes absolutely no sense. It's a ridiculous proposal.
Well, you were showing me the map of where this the mine would be located, and it's just outside the border of the Volcanic National Monument. And it's an interesting thing because it reminded me of all these proposals. I'm always getting emails to sign petitions to stop to mine on the edge of the Grand Canyon or to mine at the edge of Canyonlands. And it seems that there's thinking on the one part that if you're outside of a boundary, then it's fair game. But what's your issue with that kind of thinking?
Well, this river and the proposal is directly east of the monument. The river flows right into the monument. And even though it's on the edge of this monument, it's on National Forest public lands. And the kicker on here is that these lands were actually protected. They were first owned by Trust for Public Land for Conservation, and then they were transferred to the Forest Service and protected under an act of Congress called Land and Water Conservation Fund Act. And that act is to protect the conservation values and the recreation values for the land. Now, putting a mine there just sounds crazy. I'm sure the listeners are like, "What? How is that even possible?" But the mine company, which is a Canadian company, by the way, coming into our neck of the woods to trash our area, is trying. And it would be a huge precedent to set. If we put a mine on Land and Water Conservation Fund lands, there's millions of these acres of lands that have been protected across the country that people rely on for their livelihoods, for recreation, for species, and it would be a travesty. But the agency is considering a permit, and we're very soon going to hear back from the agency on whether they say yes or no. And they're going to say yes for the fourth time, and we'll fight to stop them.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Matt Little, and we will soon be hearing from Michael Orzech, who are both with the Cascade Forest Conservancy. And we're talking this morning about plans to put a mine in right at the edge of the Mount St. Helens National Volcanic Monument. Well, you mentioned four times that you fought this off. So let's have a little bit of history about all these other permit proposals that happened that were approved and how you were able to stop them.
Yeah. So the first stage in a mining development is the company goes for an exploratory permit. It's not for the full-out mine. It's for exploration. And the agency, I believe, has blinders on because they look at the exploratory portion. This is where they're drilling, doing core samples to see if what they think is down there is down there. And the agencies have been approving these exploratory permits. Each stage, we've stopped them based on incomplete permits on the mine, on the side of the mine and the agency. So we've been successful in stopping the process mistakes that they've made. This fourth time, they have a strong permit, like they've done it across all their T's and everything. And so we have a strong case on the actual project itself because we believe strongly that the exploratory portion of the mine, this permit, would have devastating effects itself on the water and the system. We're talking about 60 core drilling sites on 20-something pads all around the river. 24/7 will be operations all summer long. They'll be using 5,000 gallons of water from the river each day, if they don't truck in supplemental water, they squirt chemicals down there as they drill the core samples, and then they seal it with this nasty stuff too. They say they're going to treat the water and then return it back to the stream, but just that impact itself and the 24/7 mining operations would totally disturb the whole area and all the recreational wildlife values. That's a strong case of ours. And then the second portion of why our case is so strong, and a judge that actually basically agreed with a lot of this, is that this land, the exploratory portion is only going to lead to a full-out mine. The agency is only looking at the exploratory portion. But what I say is, why would you even allow an exploratory permit if you know the mine itself would be illegal and contrary from U.S. law? So that's where we're at. We're about to hear a word back from the agencies, and we're going to have to object to it immediately and try to stop it that way.
Well, why would they allow a permit for something that is flat out illegal?
Well, so in their defense a little bit, they would say that mining claim the company, the Canadian company, has a right to explore their own claim. Because these are mining claims of what's underneath the ground. And even though the mine itself would be illegal, they would say that the company has the right to explore their mining claim.
Well, if they can't go ahead and actually build a mine, what's the point of doing the exploration?
Aha! Yes, I don't know. I don't get it. They think they must have a 0.01% chance and it's worth it to go for it. And we think they have a 0% chance. Well, there's enough chance that we're going to have to fight pretty hard and put together a really strong case. And we need a lot of citizens and stuff to join us. And Michael, you want to?
Actually, I was going to ask what the campaign is. And Michael, you're.
Well, I was just going to add one thing that, you know, the dangers from this kind of mine are not just hypothetical. Some listeners might be familiar with, for example, the Gold King mine in Colorado or the Mount Polly mine in Canada, where a tailings pond, just like the kind that Matt described, would be built here near Mount St. Helens. A tailings pond ruptured and sent thousands of gallons of toxic material into local watersheds. So this is the kind of thing that we're looking at, and it's very possible that that would happen here as well. So we certainly want to prevent this kind of mining from occurring in our public lands.
So what's your campaign plan to stop the mine, besides just filing a lawsuit or whatever, or appealing a decision? What else are you doing on the ground to basically generate awareness of this and hopefully mobilization to stop it?
Sure. So this campaign has been underway for a long time already, and we spent a lot of time gathering petitions against the mine. We sent a letter along with 19 other partner nonprofits and companies that co-signed opposing the letter. We've worked with both Washington senators as well, and Senator Cantwell sent a letter, a comment letter as well, opposing the mine. We even got a rock band, Modest Mouse, involved. They're opponents of the mine, and they helped spread the word about our campaign. So we've been doing a lot of work already, and we're sort of waiting now for a decision from these two agencies before we can move forward.
So what's, and you're expecting these two agencies to approve the permit?
Yes, they're considering it right now. It's Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service, and it's a modified permit. We won a couple years ago on challenging the permit about a year and a half ago, and now they're modifying it. It should be released anytime now. We're actually surprised we haven't heard about it yet. We hope they're not just holding it out for Christmas time when no one can respond. But when they do put it out, we need public comments, as we have in the past. Like Michael said, we got important folks like Modest Mouse. Isaac Brock really hates this mine. So if anyone is a fan of Modest Mouse, you should also be against this mine, because it's a terrible, crappy mine, and we got to stop it.
I'm just wondering if the coming national elections will have any effect on whether this mine happens or not.
I don't think so. It's a, you know, it's an administrative decision, and like Michael said, we have our senators Murray and Cantwell have been supportive on this. They've both written different letters and comments and trying to figure out ways to help. The state agency, the wildlife agency, has actually commented as well that this is an inappropriate project because this is a steelhead gene bank, as I mentioned before. This kind of activity is completely contrary to that. So we have a lot of support. In 2008, we had 33,000 public comments against this. More recently, we got a number, big chunk of comments. We got local communities downstream that are affected by this. The town of Kelso passed a resolution this past summer against the mine, and Castle Rock and Longview have passed resolutions in the past as well, because their drinking supply will be directly affected by this.
So you keep saying that you expect this permit to be approved. So then what's the next stage?
Next stage is administrative objection. You have, I think, 30 days to object administratively. The public can too. When that's done, there'll be a final decision, and then you have to use your lawyers. We work with a great team at the Lewis and Clark Law School, and we will be challenging this as we have before. We think this time we'll win, though, because we have the Land and Water Conservation Fund on our side, as well as thousands of people there's barely anyone in the community who thinks this is a good idea. There would be about half a dozen jobs from this, maybe more like 10 to 12 jobs, but only half of them would be local. They've already said that the other half would be flown in from Canada. It'd be very specialized jobs. And that those few jobs are not worth destroying this whole valley for a long time.
Interestingly, you made a point that this is a Canadian mining company, and this seems to be kind of a tactic that Canadian mining companies, and there's several of them, that they're pretty notorious for putting in very unwanted mines throughout Latin America. So I guess they're just treating us like another third world country.
Yeah, like Michael said, if you Google Mount Pali mine disaster, just look and see at what happened. There's another gold and copper mine that I've worked on before, a pebble mine in Alaska, also would have destroyed the largest run of sockeye on the planet, also would have had ridiculously huge toxic tailings ponds, square miles of this nasty
And that
stuff.
One was killed, wasn't it, I think?
Or yeah, still have a... EPA actually precluded them from getting a wetlands permit, because I've flown over that area, and it is a complete wetlands, like the whole thing is a wetland, so EPA couldn't grant them a permit, so they've kind of... prevented this from happening, which is what we would like the agencies to actually do here. Say, hey, you can't build a mine anyway, so why even explore? Why put the resources at risk? It makes no sense to me. I think they should be embarrassed that they're even approving or looks like they will be approving an exploratory permit.
Does the EPA come into play at all during these processes?
You know, I don't know, and I'm Nicole runs our campaign. She's the lawyer. I'm not sure. I don't think they do because it's not a wetland, but it may come into some of the effluent that comes.
Because the Clean Water Act.
Clean Water Act. It's got to be part of the case. Yeah. I just don't know for sure.
And then the other wild card, of course, is that it's a volcano. And that
yeah. Sure. An active one.
Right.
It's so crazy. I don't understand how we're still talking about this.
So what would you like listeners to do?
Sure. Well, when we started the program, we didn't talk a whole lot about a lot of our programs. So maybe I can go over a little bit of what we do and how listeners can get involved. So our mission is to protect and sustain the forest streams, wildlife, and communities in the heart of the Cascades through conservation, education, and advocacy. So that mouthful means that we do a lot of programs, and all of them fit into conservation, education, and advocacy. One, probably the most fun way to get involved that I'll mention now, because it's kind of a timely thing, is that next Thursday, not this Thursday, but the following Thursday, November 3rd at 6:30, we're going to have a big celebration of our name change. So like Matt said, this summer we changed our name to the Cascade Forest Conservancy. And we'll be celebrating that at the Columbia Sportswear flagship store downtown on Broadway. Really nice venue. There'll be a reception with a silent auction, drinks, fun games, and then a program with a live auction and all kinds of festivity. And it's great because all the proceeds go to our work, but you also get to have a fun time and meet fellow-minded environmental activists. So.
And we'll be talking about the mine.
And we'll be talking a lot about the mine.
Now, are there ways for people to get involved in terms of doing outreach and whether
Certainly.
It's signing petitions or going door-to-door or whatever other activities?
Yeah, just first on the mine, there is a petition on our website that people can sign against that they're against the mine. But
And your website is what?
CascadeForest.org. There's also a sign up for our event that Michael just talked about, and I think he's going to talk about some of the other ways to join and you get our newsletter and stuff like that.
Certainly. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah. So again, that's cascadeforest.org. We also have a Facebook page. You can follow us at Cascade Forest. So you can check that out. And in addition to our event, there are many ways to get involved. We love to have people get in touch with us. So a big thing we do is volunteer and stewardship programs. Our volunteer season runs from roughly April to October. So we're just wrapping up this year's, but we'll have a lot of opportunities next spring and summer to go on restoration and science trips. And these are a lot of fun. We have programs both for adults and for kids. So our kind of flagship volunteer program is our Gifford Pinchot Stewards program. And these are awesome trips. Our conservation science director, Shiloh Halsey, runs most of them. So it's basically like going on a hike, but you have this interpretive science component. You learn a lot. We do things like surveying old growth stands, surveying roads that we think might have blocked culverts or need to be decommissioned. We might be reseeding areas that have burned.
Actually, you reseed burned areas? I thought that you're supposed to just leave them alone.
Well, it depends. There are some areas that I've actually burned many times over and are so barren that they do need some...
A little bit of help.
Yeah, some restoration, getting native grasses going again. This year, we also are trying to really integrate climate change mitigation into our work, something that is really important to, you know.
And how are you doing that?
Well, again, this is where volunteers are really important. We've identified several watersheds that are at special risk from climate change, especially due to overheating, becoming too warm. So we're trying to plant a lot of native trees and grasses along certain key watersheds that are at risk. So next summer, that's going to be part of our work as well.
And we have a report coming out in mid-November that's going to be a review of all the impacts on species and habitats in the Cascade region of impacts from climate change. It's a project we just started last year. And the results of it will be recommendations that are both policy things that the agencies can do, also things on the ground that we can do with our volunteers through some of these restoration projects that Michael mentioned.
Now, are you going to be taking people out to the Green River Valley to give a sense of what this area is that needs to be protected?
Yep. Actually, a group was there just on Friday. We'll do another trip next spring. It's hard to get back on some of these roads into these areas after the rains start. So that's why our volunteer season is usually kind of late spring to early, mid-fall.
So you don't do snowshoeing trips?
That would be fun.
It's not a bad
Shiloh,
idea.
If you're listening, let's do some snowshoeing trips.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we are talking this morning with Matt Little, who's the director of Cascade Forest Conservancy, and Michael Orczyk, who is the development director. And we've been talking about this proposed mine that we'll probably talk a little bit more about before we're out, that's being proposed right on the edge of the boundaries of the Mount St. Helens National Volcanic Monument. And we're also just talking about the organization and how you can get involved in getting to know the Gifford Pinchot National Forest better. So actually, do you go, since you've changed your name, are your boundaries of your purview wider now than Gifford Pinchot, or is it still basically the same area?
It's always been a little wider. I think this name just describes it better. But we work on the forests between Mount Rainier and the Columbia Gorge, the Cascade Forests. So most of that is the Gifford Pinchot National Forest and some of the wilderness areas in there, that, like Indian Heaven. But, you know, we pay attention to, there's a lot of private lands in there and state lands around the edge. We've had some issues, obviously. This is all connected habitat, so we're working on the whole area. Our specialty is focusing on the National Forest. We are the only broad-based conservation group in that area. Most ecoregions, especially in the Northwest, have multiple conservation groups working. But we are really unique that this is kind of our habitat of where we work, and we work in concert with other groups through two different collaboratives in the forest, in the north half and the south half. These are stakeholders that get together on a regular basis, from folks who are in the logging industry, the local community, county commissioners, us, and other folks who have an interest on forest management. We get together monthly in two different groups. And that's been going on for almost a decade, at least in one of them. And we try to work with the Forest Service on their decisions and on timber sales, and try to work out issues ahead of time before it all gets on paper and controversial. And it's been a great success because everyone can express how they feel about a project and actually can work with the Forest Service specialists to try to improve them. And we've had two big wins in this past year through this process, two different big timber sales where we have prevented certain areas from cutting too close to the streams. We've prevented some areas where we thought the Forest Service was cutting too heavily into spotted owl breeding areas, habitat areas, And we've also, we're trying to change a practice where we're seeing things that look like clear cutting again in the forest under certain restoration and habitat goals that the Forest Service has. They are doing things that look a lot like clear cutting, which really worries us. And so we've changed the prescriptions a little bit through some of these negotiations.
Actually, I've been out in the woods a few places where it's pretty, you see like, they look like clear cuts, but they have a few trees standing.
Exactly.
And they have another name for it. I forget.
Regeneration harvest.
Ron Wyden's kind of been a supporter of this, unfortunately, and some other people who should, Peter DeFazio, people who should know better, it seems.
Yeah, ironically, we talked to the scientists that kind of started a lot of this.
That was Jerry Franklin.
Uh-huh.
And I actually had wonderful interviews with Jerry Franklin years ago about the biscuit burn, where he was just like right on top of how it was so wrong to go in and do any cutting there.
Yeah.
And I mean, he was an architect of the Northwest Forest Plan. So I've been wondering what happened to Jerry Franklin.
Well, Jerry's a great guy, and we actually helped him teach a course up in the forest a couple weeks ago. But he, so the idea behind this new kind of cutting is to try to get diversity on landscape, including habitat for deer and elk. It's called early sarrel habitat. However, we found out that even Jerry Franklin, who proposed some of these things, said that you really shouldn't leave any less than 30 to 40% of the crown cover. It's by crown cover. You look up in the sky and see how much of the crown covers the sky. There shouldn't be less than 30 to 40% crown cover. And we were seeing proposals where the Forest Service, even recently, had 5 to 15% crown cover. That's just a couple trees standing up in a big clear cut. They're going to blow down. It doesn't seem to be like a good habitat. And even the Jerry Franklin doesn't think that's a good idea. So I don't understand how the Forest Service is putting that together. So we're hoping to change that. And we're pretty sure in the next proposals there's going to be, you know, more appropriate types of experiments for these things. That's why when we were saying they're cutting too close to the riverbanks, there's a buffer areas that have been protected for years. And there are some legitimate reasons to try to thin out these plantation stands, which have been created from the historical clear cuts. They'd clear cut, plant a bunch of trees of the same age. They'd grow up all kind of dense, same age, young trees. And we all agree, conservationists and the Forest Service, that we should thin those. They're trying to do that in buffer areas along streams as well. And there's legitimate reasons to do it, but there's also a lot of impacts when you do it. So we negotiate how far away from the riverbank you can cut. We always take the precautionary approach. Forest Service seems to be a little bit more experimental. So we work it out, but we wish there was more standards. And I think I mentioned before this that the Northwest Forest Plan is up for revisions after 20 years, and that's a big deal. What comes out of that is a big question mark, and some of these principles we want to make sure, like, don't cut too close to the streams. We want to make sure that that survives.
So is Jerry Franklin kind of coming on board as far as saying that they've taken his science and kind of run the wrong way with it?
He was surprised when I told him what they were doing. So, yeah, I'm gonna talk to Jerry a little bit more about that.
Yeah, actually, I should have him on sometime because I've been very curious about this model that he came up with for forest restoration, and I don't understand the science of it myself. It seems like even 30% canopy coverage is really very small.
We think so.
Yeah,
we think 60% should really be a minimum for clear cut. You want to leave some gaps. There's called the skips and gaps. You don't have to heavily thin a massive area to create deer and elk habitat. We've even shown some of these areas don't need the deer and elk habitat that they say is needed. But you can achieve these gaps by couple acre gaps here and there of what looks like a mini clear cut. But it's basically a gap that you're recreating that from either a blowdown or from disturbance that's happened in the past that doesn't. Mudslides still happen, but you're trying to replicate the mosaic that was on the landscape before we messed with things. And fire is one of the things that's been excluded for so long. And the way we've replanted these clear cuts is also wrong. It's come together as a major mess. And so we're trying to fix it, but we have to do it very carefully. We shouldn't just do this one prescription for a huge landscape that just leaves a few trees on here. You can jump around, do little gaps, do some light thinning, which we all think would be beneficial in these plantation stands. And I think we'd get the same kind of effect that we want on wildlife and on the forest. We want these forests to promote the old growth characteristics that used to be there and have a lot of big trees mixed up with small trees, some gaps in the forest, and a lot of habitat and places to recreate.
I wonder how much you coordinate with some of your fellow groups in Oregon, like who are protecting the Mount Hood National Forest, like BARC and Oregon Wild.
Yeah, they're great partners of ours, and both of those groups are the ones I would have listed. We get together once in a while, a lot of the executive directors of the groups actually that have offices in the Portland area, and we share things. We have different ways of doing things, some of these groups. But I think we partner mostly with Washington groups on our side. Conservation Northwest is a good partner. and we have Friends of Mount Adams, who actually is in the forest. It's a volunteer group. We have Mount Adams Resource Stewards and some other groups like the Mount St. Helens Research Institute. They do a lot of work with kids and getting them out into the Mount St. Helens area. And we actually partnered this year on a project with a camp to get kids connected to nature, which is one of our big goals.
How about with the tribes?
Yeah, we've had some partnerships because they've been participating in those collaboratives with us that I mentioned. And also, we're all trying to promote huckleberry growth. Huckleberries used to exist and be more healthy in these open, thinned forests. And some of the canopies closing up in certain areas that used to have fire. Actually, the Native Americans used fire to try to promote these areas. They knew much more about forest management than we're just picking up on things right now that they knew a lot better than us. But we're trying to replicate some of the things that fire did in the forest to promote huckleberries, which is super important to the Native Americans out here.
Well, just in the last few moments, I want to get back to that mine. So let's kind of recapitulate about this mine and what people can do to help prevent it from becoming an actuality.
Yeah, I think if you can jump on our website and go on to our section on mining, you can find out what you can do.
You should say your website slowly.
Cascadeforest.org. And then on that, there's a drop-down menu of our work. And under that is the mine. That has a list of all sorts of things you can do. You can also become a member of ours, and I'm taking your wind here.
What did Michael say?
Well, you know, like KBOO, we are member-supported. So if there are any listeners out there who are members, first of all, we're very grateful for your support. And, yeah, you can go, like Matt said, cascadeforest.org and become a member. Even a small donation really helps us get our work done, like fighting this mine. So thank you to all members, and please sign up. Yeah.
Yeah, we're all volunteer run. I mean, we are run on volunteer donations completely. Some is through foundations, but a lot of it is through individuals like those who listen here and live in the community. We have a lot of members in the Portland-Vancouver area, actually probably most of our members. And when you're a member, all it takes to be a member is to give any amount online. If you give $10, you end up on our e-newsletter list, and you'll get all the updates on the mine and such. So within the next month, we're thinking we'll hear about the mine. We'll send out an alert to our members. We'll put on Facebook too, and people can respond with comments. If you meet one of our folks at the door, our canvassers, they'll have a postcard you can sign. That's how you met our folks,
that's
right?
That's right.
Yeah, so we have different ways like that. And and the event. If you can come to the event, it's November 3rd on Thursday at Columbia Sportswear. It will be a blast. We had so much fun last year. Our first event like that at Patagonia last year. It was our 30th anniversary. This year we're celebrating our new name. And we're going to have a special video about the mine, a special appeal about the mine. I'll be talking about it a little bit more, get people riled up to do something.
Well, let's do a follow-up once that decision is made and we can see where to go from here.
Okay, great.
So I want to thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking this morning with Matt Little, who's Executive Director of Cascade Forest Conservancy, and Michael Ordzik, who is the Development Director. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Had fun.
And we've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll talk with Jin Johns, author of Urban Forests. And my engineer is Derek Crooks. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the Neville Brothers. Thanks for listening.
Fire on the mountain. Fire! Fire on the mountain.